Welcome to the I Believe podcast, an Acure Insight production, brought to you by Castle Biosciences. I'm your host, Danae Peterson, a fellow ocular melanoma survivor. Here on the podcast, we'll be sharing information and insights on treatments, research, and living with ocular melanoma.
Castle Biosciences is a proud sponsor of this I Believe podcast. Castle Biosciences tests are designed to provide clinicians precise and personalized tumor information for the benefit of patient care. If you would like more information about how Castle is transforming the treatment of eye cancer, visit castletestinfo.com.
All right, welcome back, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that little break. And we just want to give a quick shout out before we jump into our premier sponsor, Castle Biosciences. They develop and commercialize diagnostic and prognostic tests for dermatologic cancers. Their tests provide clinically actionable tumor-specific genomic information to enable more accurate treatment plan decisions. They believe that the traditional approach to developing a treatment plan for dermatologic cancers using clinical and pathology factors alone is inadequate and can be improved by incorporating personalized genomic information. I know many of you have benefited from the Castle Biosciences test, and we just wanted to give a quick thank you to them for being our sponsor. So now, welcome back for this insightful session, Coping with Your Diagnosis and Your New Normal, with Jennifer Drew. Because of Jennifer's schedule, we've pre-recorded this session, and we're excited for you to hear it. Jennifer Drew earned her master's degree in social work from the University of Southern California, and is a licensed clinical social worker with advanced certifications in oncology and palliative care. She spent her early career at City of Hope in hematology and oncology and BMT transplant. Jennifer is honored to be the inaugural clinical social worker at the Angeles Clinic and Research Institute. She sees her role within the outpatient oncology setting as a partnership with the medical team dedicated to enhancing our clients coping with the adjustments to the diagnosis and treatment. Jennifer has a history spanning over a decade of studying mindfulness and is qualified by the University of Massachusetts to lead mindfulness-based stress reduction, or MBSR, courses. And so there we have it. We're excited to hear from her message today.
Hi, thank you so much for that warm introduction. I certainly appreciate it. I am Jennifer Drew, as mentioned, and I'm delighted to be speaking today with the Acure Insight family about coping with your diagnosis. Is this your new normal? And there's a question mark there is really important, and we'll talk more about that as we go through our discussion today. So just to overview the way we are going to approach the topic today, we're going to start with defining, recognizing, and normalizing response to diagnosis. Then we'll go into constant reminders that might be present about your diagnosis. Then we'll talk about a little bit about how to work with family, friends, and strangers, some common themes that have come up in my work with our clients. I'll talk about resilience and self-care. And then we'll move on to additional coping strategies, things that might be helpful in navigating this new terrain. And partnering with your team is a crucial part of the diagnosis, health status, and treatment process for anybody working with a diagnosis. And then there will be a few resources that on a national level that I'd be delighted to share with you, in addition, of course, to Acure Insight. And the image I have on the screen is actually an important image for me. It captures for me one of the ways that I talk with our clients and patients about what might be happening when a diagnosis shows up. And the brick wall is essentially the diagnosis. You are happily going about your life with a view to what you expected your life to be. And for most people, the views that they held of their future lives did not include receiving a diagnosis, which is how the brick wall comes into be. When the diagnosis arrives, we can no longer see the vision that we had for our life. So we don't know if we're going to tunnel through the wall, smash through the wall, go up and over. So there can be a lot of emotional reactions that arise when we can't see the life in front of us that we had anticipated living. So one of the things that's important is to ask or to think about, why are my emotions like a roller coaster? I might be having increased irritability, increased sadness, decreased energy, a crisis of faith, or I might be surrounded with toxic positivity. So some of these symptoms and some of these issues are related to grief. And it's important to think about grief and what does grief have to do with the new normal? So grief is something that arises for any type of loss. Most commonly in our culture, we talk about grief in response to death and dying. However, grief is a set of emotions that may arise for any type of loss. It could be changes in employment. It could be changes in our health status, changes in our relationship status, changes in our routines. There can be grief reactions related to the changes over the last 3 years of COVID. The thing that we do know is that grief, when it comes, is nothing like we expected to be. This quote that I have on the slide from Joan Didion, a prolific writer, grief is not something that we go through and then it's over. It's a process that will take each of us our own time to work through. There's no defined timeline for working through the issues that come up surrounding changes in health. And grief can impact not only our emotions, but also our social interactions and ourselves physically. There are many different theories of grief. The one that we might be most familiar with is the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, the anger, the bargaining, the denial, the depression, and also the acceptance. Now, one of the things to notice is, as I mentioned, it's not a linear process. You don't go from denial to sadness to depression to bargaining to acceptance. What happens for many people is that these stages might occur at the same time. You might have sadness and anger at the same time, or bargaining and a crisis of faith at the same time that we're in acceptance. So there might be more than one aspect of an emotional response at the time that we receive a diagnosis. So does this mean that grief becomes our new normal? Perhaps for a time. And it's not abnormal or out of the realm of thinking that grief might come in waves. So at the beginning of a diagnosis and a treatment plan, it's a busy time. And I've worked with clients who they went through a year of treatment, but the grief and the emotional response to their diagnosis didn't come until after the year of treatment. So don't be surprised if you've been diagnosed for a year or more and you're just now noticing changes in your emotional response. You might encounter sometimes feeling great, feeling in acceptance for long periods of time, but then you might come to a scan or you might have a change in treatment plan, and that might trigger an episode of grief. So it's really how we relate to our emotions that become really our new normal. It's developing a relationship with emotions that we might not have had or experienced prior to our diagnosis. So what we want to do, and this term is used quite a bit in the oncology world, is this idea of new normal. And Bringing to mind for myself the idea of mindfulness or one day at a time, or even if a day at a time is too much, if it's a really strong day, you might just take an hour at a time, or a minute at a time, or even just one breath at a time. The grief or the emotions that are coming up are very purposeful. It's to help you accept the reality of the loss of the health that you experienced prior to your diagnosis. It's to help with working through emotions and thoughts. It's to incorporate the loss of health without your current diagnosis into life. So life changes every day. And sometimes it's not until we have a health crisis or some other type of loss that we realize our life is going to be different from here on out. So there are many considerations to think about when we talk about coping. One of the things we talk about is the relationship we develop with the diagnosis and our health status. In fact, an example, I was speaking to a caregiver yesterday, and I asked her at the end of the call, "Would you like an update by phone?" And what she said to me was, "No, I prefer email because if I'm having a good day, I don't want a phone call from the clinic to upset me and ruin my day. With email, I have control and choice around when I read emails from clinic." And so this is really important to think about. What is the relation that you, or if you're a caregiver, that you have with the diagnosis and with your health status? And noticing, are there certain causes or triggers of emotions that you notice? Are there certain patterns that you're noticing as you experience various emotions? So, do you notice perhaps you're angry when you know that you have to go to clinic for several hours for an infusion? Or are you sad when you know that you are going to have a sleepless night because you have scans the next day? So, notice if there's a relationship, a pattern, some kind of causal and a relationship or cause and effect to the emotions that come up. Are there times when you notice you go more into the bargaining phase, the why me? And important to consider, not all of us are going to respond the same way. There are many, many, many factors that can influence how we cope with a new diagnosis. These can include culture, of course, religion or spiritual orientation, age, gender, race or ethnicity, your personality, and your mental health status and history. Other things that might influence how we cope with the diagnosis might include your role in the family. Are you at the head of the household? Are you a sole provider for a household? Are you a parent, a child? Are you a caregiver for your older parents and your younger children? So noticing all the influences that may come to play as you learn how to cope with your diagnosis than to go to the doctor on a different frequency than maybe before your diagnosis. These are all important things to consider as we think through how we're going to cope. Now, the thing is, as I mentioned before, and I thought that this image really illustrated beautifully how we want our grief to work or our emotional response to our diagnosis to work is A to B. Connect two dots and not have it be messy. Well, as you can see on the right-hand side, this is a more accurate representation of how grief actually works. It is sometimes we'll take steps forward, backwards, up, down, sideways, and it's sometimes difficult to predict how we'll be working with our emotions around diagnosis and health status and those changes. The thing that we do know is that no two people are the same, no two days are the same, and no two responses to the same thing will ever be the same. So by noticing the unique aspects of your emotions and developing the relationship with your emotions, this will give you better information on how to be with the grief. There might be things that you can do, but you might also at certain points be able to just notice, oh, that's the grief. Okay, well, let me wait a little bit and I'm sure it will change, because it always does change. It never stays the same. So the normal response to grief, the normal list of emotions that happen on this grief journey, we don't know how long it will last. I know some spiritual traditions prescribe grief processes and maybe 11 months or 12 months. However, with a medical status, a medical diagnosis, we can't say what might be a trigger for emotions and what might be just something different so that you might be okay with. So there are these four ideas that are another part of a theory about grief responses. So the four headings are reeling, and reeling is really the first aspects, very similar to the Kubler-Ross idea of denial, but it's also the shock and the disbelief about how did this diagnosis happen to my body? The next idea is feeling. So not only do we have anger and sadness, but I've spoken with a lot of people who have guilt. They have anguish. They find that their concentration's impacted. They have sleep disturbances, appetite changes, fatigue, other physical symptoms, pain, aching. So things are just different in the emotional landscape and also in the physical body. And so the mind and the body work together to produce so many different types of feeling, physical and emotional, that would be within the realm of normal. It would be normal to have all of these experiences, anxiety. This is physical and emotional stress happening at the same time. And then the next type of response you might see is we learn to deal and adapt to the loss. So when this begins to happen, you might notice you have longer stretches between an acute grief response. And as you start to have longer and longer stretches, you start to notice things that might be working for you. You might have a steady, stable treatment plan that's working for you. You've gotten into the rhythm of the new normal, so to speak. And you might be able to start to think about a way to transcend, to navigate around, over, through, or under that brick wall that used to be the diagnosis. And then we begin the healing journey. The loss becomes part of the bereaved. So in this case, the diagnosis becomes a part of life. And the acuity, so the acute anguish begins to soften. And this is an important thing, because what I want to really bring attention to is that we don't say the anguish goes away, but rather what we're talking about is that the anguish, the acuity of the emotional response might soften a bit. It might not be as harsh-edged as it previously was. There are so many different things to consider when we're thinking about our response. Fear is a reasonable part of this. The possible unknowns, potential side effects, And I mentioned the guilt about depending on others or asking other people for help can be very difficult for many people. And noticing that you might feel differently as you go through and might never feel as you once did. So that's part of the acceptance and the softening. There are times, though, when we would be concerned about the emotions being experienced, and we want to make sure to know that when we start to notice that we might be lacking basic self-care or hygiene, having suicidal thoughts, attempts, we might be isolating socially or abusing substances, including over-the-counter and prescription medications. If we're having extreme lifestyle changes, so for example, we're going from 0 to 60 working out, is that something that we want to keep an eye on, talk to our doctors about, make sure that's something that's, we should be seeking. Extreme or unintentional weight changes, that can, of course, be a side effect of treatment. If your cancer center has a dietitian, it's a great person to build a relationship with along the way. And then persistent sleep disturbances. So am not insomnia that lasts for more than 2 weeks, sleep deprivation, or hypersomnia, which is sleeping too much. And sleep is something that we notice that can be very disrupted. Now, it's normal if the night before a scan, for example, that it's hard to sleep. There's some anxiety there. But if disruptions around sleep happen for more than 2 weeks, then it's time to seek professional help. And if you, as a patient, notice these things happening for yourself, or as a caregiver, notice this in the person with the diagnosis, there is a mental health hotline on a national level, 988, and you'll want to call 988 and let your treatment team know that you're seeing some concerning things happening. A lot of cancer centers have social workers like myself, or psychiatric support, or symptom management support, dietitians that can really help. But if you're in crisis, you want to call 988 for mental health support. Another thing that's incredibly difficult to cope with are the constant reminders of the diagnosis. So, whereas you might have had short, dark hair, you might have become bald, and then your hair might have come in as gray and curly if it started to grow back. So hair loss is a big deal for men and women. Of course, vision changes or eye loss are overt. They change the way you see the world and the way people see you. Having a port or bruising, having scars or surgeries, changes in your physical body, changes, as we talked about, in weight can happen. Neuropathy, fatigue, changes in intimacy. And I think this subject is one that is so profound. It often gets missed by the treatment team. And a lot of providers are not asking about intimacy. And this is an important thing to think about. And it goes hand in hand with role changes in relationships. So, if, for example, you were the provider and you went to work every day, and now since diagnosis and treatment, you aren't able to go to work every day, your partner or spouse or loved one or child or parent are now taking care of you, perhaps even bathing you. This can really influence the ability to maintain emotional intimacy in your primary relationship. And that's something that can really benefit from sitting down together with a therapist or a counselor to really talk about, this is what's different in my relationship. You know, I'm concerned that my caregiver or partner is overburdened. I'm feeling guilty. I'm not feeling any intimacy, emotional or sexual. So this is a topic that is important to notice and to receive counseling for, to talk about with your spouse, as it's something that's not consistently addressed by the MD or the medical team. And of course, we've talked about weight fluctuations and a relationship with the dietitian is always helpful. So because of these constant reminders, it can be hard to develop coping skills. And that can be further compounded in the face of family, friends, and strangers. You know, family, friends, and strangers can be well-meaning, and sometimes their response might be compassionate. They might listen to you. But other times, family, friends, or strangers might feel guilty about doing too little. They might be anxious about not doing the right thing. They might be angry about the diagnosis. And they might have understanding, and oftentimes they might lack understanding about what it is you're going through. A lot of people haven't been trained to just ask you how you're doing. How is it today? And they might respond with toxic positivity. Oh, think positively, you'll be just fine. Or, oh, you know, just ignore this or ignore that. Oh, they might just minimize what it is you say, and that can actually trigger an emotional response for you because they are minimizing, I'm having a bad day, I'm in pain. Oh, you know, everybody's in pain sometimes. Well, that's minimizing, and it can be really triggering and upsetting to have your friends, family, or even strangers on the street who might say, what's wrong? Say, oh, be positive, you'll be fine. Or my Aunt Judy had XYZ diagnosis and this happened to her. And these people might give you unwanted opinions, solutions, and stories. They might desire to help in the way that they feel are beneficial without asking you what you need. They might not know what to say or fear saying the word cancer. They might be saying the wrong thing. So one of the strategies to cope with that is to set boundaries with friends, family, and strangers. To say no when necessary. To set limits on what is acceptable. And this can also be important if you're in the workplace about learning how to navigate what accommodations you might need and how open you wish to be in the workplace about your health status, your diagnosis, and your treatment. The good news is that human beings are resilient, and with self-care and self-compassion, we give ourselves the same kindness and care we'd give a good friend. And this is the primary coping strategy, is to learn self-care and self-compassion. To allow yourself time for your emotions to be what they are. To notice that it's okay to be sad. To notice that if I'm feeling guilty too often, maybe I should speak with somebody. To start to develop awareness around the emotions and the responses that you're having to various situations. So the starting point of resilience is self-compassion and self-care. We want to recognize the feelings The resilience is defined as a dynamic process of maintaining positive adaptation and effective coping strategies in the face of adversity. Well, what does this mean? I live in Los Angeles, and I use this image because there's times when I'm driving on our very overpacked highways, and I'm stopped in bumper-to-bumper traffic in the fast lane. And I look down to the median at my left, and I see that there's something growing. There's literally a plant growing from the crack in the asphalt in the middle of a 10-lane highway. And that is the definition of resilience. Even in the face of what looks like complete adversity, life finds a way to thrive and adapt. It's dynamic. So we as humans are dynamic, and we have the ability to adapt. So some of the attributes that we've seen in successful resilience and people who develop the attributes to become resilient during this time is curiosity. Curiosity about their own experiences. As so I've been talking about learning to recognize the emotions and the triggers of the emotions. Empathy, again, self-compassion, self-care. And also empathy for others, the caregivers who are stuck or don't know how to care, don't know, quote unquote, the right things to say. So teaching them with empathy, learning from experiences along the way. So the longer you're in a treatment plan, the more experiences you'll have, and you'll learn that the scans might not be as scary as you thought they were the first time, and they might get better the second and third time. Flexibility. So learning how to be less rigid. So for example, if there's a delay in a doctor's appointment, can you be flexible? Can you work with that? Or are you so rigid that you become upset and angry? Developing and building good self-esteem. This is something that can be really powerful going through and working with a diagnosis. Building good self-esteem can sometimes be benefited by working with a really good therapist. You know, a cancer diagnosis is oftentimes a trauma. So working with a therapist is always a good idea. And of course, I'm biased as a therapist myself. But working with a therapist to build good self-esteem can help build the resilience that can help navigate this territory and terrain. Being intuitive. So starting to notice intuitively what it is that you need. Are you thirsty? Are you hungry? Are you tired? Are you fatigued? What it is it that you need in this moment? So starting to really get to know yourself will help you to lead and develop and guide with your intuitive nature. Optimism. Now, some of us are naturally optimistic, some of us are naturally pessimistic, and some of us are somewhere in between. And so optimism is really different from toxic positivity. But realistic optimism can be really helpful. And feeling both internally and externally well-resourced. So internally well-resourced means that you have a handle on your relationship with your emotions. Building that relationship with your emotions, your sense of self, who you are, can really contribute to being internally well-resourced. And externally well-resourced speaks more to having a support system in place where you know if you need something physically or from somebody else that's available. And if that's not something you have available today, it's seeking support to build that external resource system. So, you know, one of the things that we really want to think about is that relationships that create trust and love and provide role models for trust and that offer encouragement and reassurance, they actually help to bolster our own personal resilience. So it's important to think about how we tap into this resilience. So the first thing, as we've transitioned into, is making connections. So we want to make connections not only with ourselves, but with others. There could be groups, there could be talking to people in the waiting room or the infusion center, and avoid seeing crises as insurmountable is an aspect of tapping into resilience. The acceptance that change is a part of living is a really powerful thing to think about. Accepting that the world in which your diagnosis didn't exist is a fantasy, right? So accepting that the diagnosis, that the change of this diagnosis, the changes in your medical status, that they're part of living. And then moving towards goals. Goal setting can be really important. Goals are very personal, and highly recommend coming up with a set of goals that you'd like to see happen, whether that's something small like journaling, making a connection, reaching out, seeking support, learning self-compassion. These could be goals that all contribute to your overall resilience and ability to cope. And looking for opportunities for self-discovery. Similarly, this could be going for a walk if that's available to you physically, or listening to a video, something that expands your mind, helps you discover yourself, get to know yourself better. Finding opportunities to nurture a positive view of yourself and learn how to keep things in perspective. The interesting idea about perspective is that if we change the way we're looking at something, the thing that we're looking at often changes. So by changing our perspective on the problem or the issue, the diagnosis, we have the opportunity to really tap into our resilience. And this can be done, again, by speaking with counselors or support groups and really taking the opportunity for self-discovery, reading. There's books on tape. There's books, regular books. There's books that are books or talks you can listen to. So there's a lot of different ways to seek information, to learn about yourself, to understand those things that will help you maintain a hopeful outlook going forward while you're taking care of yourself. And the key, the real key, is to identify ways that are likely to work well for you as a part of your own personal strategy for fostering resilience. So this is a really personal conversation. So by maintaining this conversation with ourselves, we start to build flexibility. We start to maintain flexibility. And as we recognize feelings that are present, and we allow the feelings to be present when possible. So that might mean we allow ourselves to feel the anger in a way that is helpful, and we don't stomp all over it with toxic positivity. That allows us to identify ways to renew personal strengths and well-being. And if you see the image on the right-hand side, or it's emergency care wall. So for sadness, you might have a favorite movie. For loneliness, a good friend or family member's phone number. If you're having self-doubt, have a list of reasons why you can do things. And write that list when you're feeling good so that you can reference it. Starting a gratitude practice can be helpful. For anger, you can experience the anger in a way. And if it's, you know, if you're ready to do something differently, you can listen to calming music, go for a walk, take a hot bath. So there's different things that you can do that are emergency self-care. You know, finding a comfort blanket. They have weighted blankets for when you're worried. And then, of course, I love for other. You know, a stuffed animal, a free hug, a stress ball, your favorite book. So really thinking about and preparing for what it is you might need when you might start to feel overwhelmed by emotions. But we don't want to deny the emotions. We want to allow them to be present in a way that's healthy, that maintains well-being. And if it's physically appropriate for your current health status, having some kind of physical and emotional health maintenance, you know, having access to foods that are healthy and good can maintain a better mood. And physical health is important as well. So if running maybe was something that you enjoyed doing, or going to the gym, but that's not available if you're immunocompromised or just don't have the strength for running, what could be a substitution for some kind of physical activity? Is it leg lifts or yoga, restorative yoga? What might be available? So it's thinking in a way that increases your choices. And then developing balance in your work life, in your family life, building social support personally and professionally. So sometimes in the workplace, we need that work BFF or that work best friend who understands the people we're talking about, and also having social support in your personal life, your friends, your families. And again, to noticing when professional help is needed. We want to always acknowledge your contribution to your families, friends, and workplace. I find that, you know, when people say they feel guilty, there's never a balance that they have automatically with acknowledging their contributions. So finding a way, if you do feel any kind of guilt around the burden on your family or something that might have happened with the diagnosis or medical status, start acknowledging your contributions. And then, of course, spiritual health is incredibly important. Whether you might participate in organized religion or have a personal spirituality, or if nature is your personal spirituality, finding a way to replenish, comfort, and rejuvenate the spirit, the soul, taking the time to figure out what that is for you, because it's different for each person. We want to learn from our experiences along the way. So the past pre-diagnosis is to be learned from, not lived in. We want to live in every day that's happening right now. So in order to learn more about ourselves, we can start by asking what events have been stressful to me, and what have I done successfully in the past to release stress, to de-stress? What's been helpful when I've been distressed? Who have I reached out to in the past to help me work through a traumatic or stressful experience? And if there isn't somebody who's a friend or a family member or a colleague or coworker, maybe I should hire a professional to speak with. And so thinking about when we're overcoming obstacles, how have I been able to do that in the past? So we want to learn from our past experience so we can bring that to be successful in coping with what's happening in our current experience day to day. And really, quite importantly, I want to bring attention to the last item on the slide, which is what has helped to make me feel more hopeful about the future. And retaining hope about the future is a healthy way to work with goals, to maintain goals, and to look towards the future. Now, there are going to be times, of course, when we're irritable, feeling guilty, or sad. And what is helpful is noticing and acknowledging the existence and impact of the diagnosis. So now that you have education about the possible grief process that you might be going through related to this new diagnosis or your existing diagnosis, and you're developing awareness of healthy grief, communicate Communicate. That is the most important thing to do when you're having a wave of grief come through. Understanding the personal and professional impact of the cumulative grief you might be bearing if you've been in treatment for some years or working with this diagnosis for some years, and intentionally developing coping strategies can be strategies to help you cope with the irritability, the guilt, and or the sadness. And again, we've talked about physical and emotional health, self-care, resilience, and take an inventory of your strengths. And like I mentioned in that little cartoon, have that inventory of your strengths available and ready as a go-to so that you can go to that list when you need to be picked up, so you can be reminded of your strengths, so you can acknowledge your resilience and be grateful for those things. So compassionate self-care is one of the greatest coping tools. Life is different, so acknowledging the reality that life is different is a key tool towards moving forward. Grieve at your own pace and don't try to fix your emotional response, and don't allow your friends, family, or strangers to try and fix your emotional response. Respect your personal beliefs and be sensitive to the effect your words have on yourself. One of the words or the watchwords that I have is when I start telling myself I should be doing something, I know I'm in judgment. So notice when you're in judgment of yourself. Notice that when your harsh internal critic is telling you you should do something or you should feel guilty, just take a time out and say, you know what? I'm doing a really good job right now. Acknowledge your wins and losses. And if coping sometimes looks like depression, that's okay. However, if the depression continues for more than a week to 10 days, you do want to take professional help and seek that. Find meaning and purpose in your everyday life. And don't be afraid to refer to the diagnosis that you're working with by name. And I think I've made the case for support groups or individual therapy. Spiritual guidance can be incredibly important. And again, whether that's traditional, religious, church-based, synagogue-based guidance, mosque-based, or in nature, know that social support is key. So if you live on your own, finding ways to connect with others while developing patience and letting yourself release any unrealistic expectations, including expecting that your life would go back to how it was pre-diagnosis. This diagnosis, like any journey, changes the person who you are, and let go of the unrealistic expectations. Incorporate what you're learning along the way with the diagnosis and the medical status while practicing an attitude of understanding and acceptance that nobody is perfect. So be patient with yourself. As mentioned, the role of rituals and different practices in coping can be powerful, all the way from faith-based rituals such as prayer, Bible study, hymns, but also music, classical music, hand washing, mantras, meditation, restorative yoga, any type of yoga, in fact, breath work. Journaling can really be powerful. We all have a story trapped inside us. And spending time in nature, creating whatever ritual that honors you. And ritual can be powerful and connective to just giving order to something that doesn't make sense. But if you know that every day you take time for one of these rituals or any ritual that you come up with, that will really help having a routine and stability and normalcy in your day-to-day life. Another thing that is helpful in navigating is developing a relationship with your entire team, from your oncologist to your nurses, your care coordinator, your treatment center team, maybe even designating in your friend or family that one of them is your care coordinator and they become your spokesperson so that you're not overburdened with people asking for updates. It can be tedious and tiresome to repeat your health update to 20 different people in a day. So maybe having one person be your central care coordinator can be very helpful. So knowing that it does take a team, and knowing that your team is made up of your medical team, your friends, your family, your coworkers and colleagues, but you're at the center of it. There are a few resources I'd like to share. Of course, Acure Insight, their website, resources, and programmings are invaluable in helping navigate this diagnosis. And then there's other resources such as cancer.org, the American Cancer Society, Cancer Care, Cancer Support Communities. Immerman Angels and Cancer Hope Networks have mentors that you can speak with, and they have mentors for you and your caregivers. Of course, the supportive care teams at your treatment centers, meditation apps and content like Headspace, Calm, Insight, Timer, YouTube, and others, and individual or group therapy. And so these are some of the ways that you can develop your coping skills. I really hope that this has been helpful information for you today, and I wish you a continued good day as you continue to hear from other speakers today to build your resilience, your resources, and your toolkit to keep on moving forward on your journey. Thank you so much and have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the I Believe podcast, brought to you by Castle Biosciences. Please be sure to subscribe, and if you're so inclined, send this episode over to friends, family, and share on your social media to help spread awareness around OM. If you have a moment, leave us a brief review or consider making a donation to the links in the show notes to keep our podcast going. Feel free to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Acure Insight. We'll see you next time on the I Believe podcast.